Thanks everybody for coming. My name is Richard McGregor. I'm a senior fellow for East Asia here at Lowy. Before we get underway, I'd just like to pay my respects to the Gadigal people, the Eora Nation, past and present, for the custodianship of the land. Thank you. So I'll introduce the panel first and then give you a slight introduction to the topic. We're very lucky to have Nuri Turkel here, all the way from DC. He's the chair of the Uyghur Human Rights Project. Kelsey Munro of the Lowy Institute. David Brophy of Sydney University, who specializes in the social and political history of Xinjiang. And Mamatim Ala, who is the president of the Australian Uyghur Association. We're here to talk about an issue which I think has got a lot of attention, but given its sheer scope and dimensions, still seems to me wildly underreported and discussed. And in fact, I still think in many respects kind of hard to believe. That's the mass incarceration of Uyghur people in Xinjiang in Western China. In the name of terror, literally hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs, maybe up to a million, have been held for all manner of alleged wrongdoings, ranging from you might have a family member living abroad, you might be considered to be, you know, overly devoted to Islam. There's a whole range of things for which you can be locked up. So we've got a harsh judicial, extrajudicial detentions, people shackled to chairs, people deprived of sleep, all manner of the traditional techniques of torture, people's moves are monitored, and the like, on top of which is apparently the overarching aim of this, which is political indoctrination. People are taught to love the Communist Party, renounce their religion, and of course report on fellow inmates. Now, furthermore, this is not something that's happened. In fact, it's still happening. There's hundreds of detention centres, and I think, according to a Reuters report the other day, another 67 still under construction. And the system, of course, as you might expect, is spreading from Xinjiang to other provinces with Uyghur populations like Ningxia, I think, and places like that. So I want to start with you, Nuri. Just tell us your understanding of what's happening and what the response to that has been.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you very much for my co-panelists. And I'd like to take this opportunity to acknowledge my fellow Uyghurs in the Sydney area to making the effort to join us. And I also wanted to recognize my delegation, Mr. Merkanat, Louisa, and Dolkon, being able to make this, helping me to make this trip possible. And also like to recognize Nurgul, Mr. Jaret. I'm asked to give an overview of how we got to this point. The current humanitarian crisis that I would consider, along with many China and Uyghur experts, is one of the worst humanitarian crises that we are seeing in 2018. This has been in the making for quite a long time. It started in the 80s and the 90s. The Uyghur crisis that I like to describe as a social engineering process as started after the 9/11 attacks in the United States. China's government opportunistically claimed that China is also a victim of international terrorism and ratcheted up the pressure on the Uyghur people under the slogan of fighting against three forces. So that brought us to 2009, the Urumqi unrest. I only have 5 minutes, so I need to do a little bit quicker overview. And then 2009 was another turning point. And after the unrest in Urumqi, resulting close to 200 deaths and scores of injuries, Chinese government ratcheted up and started a real social engineering, officially banning the Uyghur language, sending Uyghur kids to inland boarding schools, and also intensifying social pressure, economic marginalization.
So what we're seeing now is, in fact, the sort of gradual
build-up.
Escalation, if you like.
And then in 2012, 2015, there were some violent incidents took place in Kunming, Beijing, and Urumqi. That made a Xi Jinping authority. Richard is an expert in CCP history and existence, realized that they got to do something to speed up the process, which is forced assimilation. So the Chinese government effectively created an enemy in the Uyghur people by using its public diplomacy, state media, labeling, psychological warfare to create a domestic atmosphere for the Uyghurs to live in a fearful society. And also the Chinese compatriots also not being very understanding and supportive of the Uyghur grievances. Oftentimes they intend them in support of the Chinese government's official policies. The real turn of events actually took place after Xi Jinping expressed his disappointment that the Uyghur people still exist as a distinct nation and why they have not been Sinified. In late 2016, Xi Jinping appointed this Communist Party chief, technically promoting him from Tibet to Urumqi, making him the top official. Give him all the necessary tools and authority to whatever that has been described as a final solution by many scholars in recent academic and news reporting.
So that the party secretary in Xinjiang is an important character in this. You think Xi Jinping has empowered him, sort of just fix this, do what you have to do.
Yes, and also there's a dark horse in this process by the name Hu Lianhe, who is a top official at the United Front, who has been supporting, promoting a very harsh policies over the year. So in his recommendation, stick and carrot and stick did not work. So the party should adhere to the stick instead. So that brought us to April 2017. The regional government implemented what's been described as de-extremification measure that sanctioned normal behaviors, social behaviors, that are not only acceptable in Western society, in liberal societies and free societies, that includes growing facial hair, adhering to Islamic diet, staying the marriage within the Uyghur communities, and practicing Islamic faith. So the government, without a clear a description and definition, kind of implemented blanket repressive, very intrusive policies. And then we start hearing about this modern-day concentration camp about 20 months ago. And when we heard the news, as you pointed out, most people were in disbelief. How would this be happening in 21st century that the government, based on AI, personally collected intelligence, includes past travel history, family connection, past writing, past performance, to lock up thousands of people. Back in early this year, my colleague and I went to talk to several senior government officials describing the situation, and most of it just scratching their hands. So this is not happening. And, you know, again, it's a disbelief. And then the last 10 months, we gained so much attraction, especially in the media, thanks to a brave journalist in Radio Free Asia who made a sacrifice by reporting. Actually, five of those six reporters happened to be U.S. citizens. The Chinese government punished. And that also helped, this media coverage helped with some underground reporting by Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, and others. Washington Post itself, to this day, have published four editorials. So this issue has become part of a daily conversation in the United States among policymakers, lawmakers, and elites, and students, and academics. So this has become a very big issue. So, okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So, okay, we're going to come back to some of those things. I'm going to go to you, David, now. You studied Xinjiang for a long time. Put this in a broader context of post-1949 PRC policy in Xinjiang, and give us a sense, even if you're surprised, at how it's been ratcheted up.
Yeah, well, everyone is surprised at the extent of what's going on, and the scale of this is clearly unprecedented. If we're going to compare it with previous campaigns in Xinjiang, of course, there's been a lot of different political campaigns. One of the really striking things, I think, at the moment is that this campaign is simultaneously targeting people inside the system and outside the system at the same time. And that's quite different. I mean, if we think back early 1950s, immediately after the Red Army arrived in Xinjiang, there was quite severe repression of religion. Then mid-1950s, it switched to targeting political elites inside the party as local nationalists. Late 1950s, back to an anti-religious campaign and so on. It's hard to think of a time where there's been a simultaneous effort to target the sort of wider population in the name of de-radicalization or anti-extremism. And that's what's been getting most of the publicity in the West. But in fact, you also have this sort of purge going on inside the party, targeting party members and intellectuals who identified as so-called two-faced people. And that is why you're seeing people who have quite a high profile, university professors and so on, also being rounded up along with, you know, people from the villages who just, you know, grow a beard or something like that too. And in fact, when I was in Xinjiang last year, there wasn't anything on the TV and radio about the camps or about the the so-called re-education process, but there was constant stream of broadcasting about this two-faced people campaign. That was actually much more prominent in the domestic discussion of what was going on. Nuri's brought up the importance of the war on terror to this context. I think that is definitely an important factor. What we have to remember is that Xinjiang is territorially part of China, but there is a long imperial or colonial history there. And so that when we think about the war on terror, we're not just comparing it to, say, the domestic war on terror in a place like America or Europe. And there are similarities there, particularly in terms of this notion that you can sort of preemptively identify people who are at risk of radicalization and, you know, grab them before they radicalize and retrain them. That is a principle that sort of informs, anti-radicalization policies in a lot of countries, obviously not on the same scale. But because of the other side of it is that a lot of what you see in Xinjiang, in fact, looks like sort of the way the war on terror is being waged in the Middle East, in a place like Iraq or Syria, so on, with this kind of biometrics, this sort of mass surveillance of the population and so on as well. And certainly when I was there, it definitely felt like I was in a war zone. I mean, barbed wire everywhere, every public building heavily guarded. The parking station attendant has a submachine gun. This is something that I'd never seen before in the sort of 15 to 16 years I've been going to Xinjiang.
I mean, on the war on terror issue, just briefly, I mean, two things. After 9/11, I think the US did designate, was it the East Turkestan Front, I think?
Islamic movement, at the request
of China as a terror group, number one. Mm. And number two, to be fair, well, not really to be fair, but there have been a number of terror attacks within China as well, which is not to say that the reaction is anything proportionate or not, but I mean, is it a serious issue inside China?
Well, I think that's clearly the way the party sees it. It does depend on how you define terrorism, because a lot of what has been referred to as terrorism in Xinjiang has been things like attacks on police stations and so on. And I think, you know, we might need to watch our language a little bit there. But no, I mean, there's no denying that there has been. But the time frame for this doesn't really coincide. That is to say, I mean, there was already a period of about a year and a half when there hadn't actually been any serious violence in Xinjiang or elsewhere in China before these new policies started to be implemented. So as a sort of direct policy response to events on the ground, I think there's a lot more going on there. Now, of course, because it's all tied up with that, it does make it very difficult for China to now wind this stuff back, because, I mean, the fact is the level of violence in Xinjiang is extremely low. It's not a militarized environment in any way. It's extremely difficult to organize anything, to even talk to anyone about politics. But, you know, a lot of people living there now do think that these policies are responsible for the fact that, you know, nothing is happening. And so it's going to be quite a brave Chinese politician to come out and say, I think we can scale things back, because if anything, any incident happens after that, they're finished.
Yeah, that's. Well, I want to bring in Kelsey now. Nuri talked about the media coverage. One of the most remarkable things about this whole event or episode has been the unfolding revelations through the media, through journalists going there, but also through satellite imagery tracking the construction of these camps and the like. Court cases in Kazakhstan have been sources of information. So could you, I mean, and as we know, the Chinese said that, you know, nothing was happening at all. Could you give us a sense of how this has unfolded in public? Because that's had an important political impact.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, the evidence base has been hugely important because, I mean, as we know, the Chinese government were denying that these camps even existed until a matter of weeks ago. And I think the build-up of the reporting and the research and the anecdotal evidence and the data has really forced a change in that position. So there has been some terrific reporting. But I think, you know, anecdotal evidence from Uyghur expats and Western journalists is sort of something the Chinese government's probably happy to dismiss, but they can't, or they've had a lot more trouble dismissing the data, which is often been Chinese language sourced, even official government documents that have been unearthed by researchers. A particularly important one has been a German one called a German guy called Dr. Adrian Zenz, and he has gone through things like provincial government budgets and found that, say, vocational spending in the budget stream went actually reduced in the last 2 years in Xinjiang, whereas domestic security and social stability streams sort of went up 300-400%. He also analysed things like recruitment ads.
You can actually see the spike in spending. Yeah.
So like recruitment for what they call assistant police, sort of low-level security jobs, went up 700-fold since Chen Chengguo took over as party secretary and implemented some of these techniques. But probably the most impactful has been the satellite imagery because analysing some of the government tender documents on construction stuff, people have found locations. And you can see from the satellite imagery these facilities have watchtowers and, you know, multi-layer perimeter fencing and large-scale dormitories, and get a lot of a sense of what these camps look like and the sense of the scale of them, which is, as you know, as we've said, kind of unbelievable. And from there you can sort of calculate capacity, and that's when you start to get some sort of evidence behind these sorts of numbers that are north of 500,000 to 1 million people interned.
So the Chinese government over time has gradually recalibrated its statements as each new sort of batch of information arrives.
Yeah, that's right. It's sort of, they've been forced to change their position from these camps don't exist to, oh, well, yeah, they're there, but they're schools or they're vocational training centres. And, I mean, that's been something that was sort of forced on them by this build-up of evidence, I think.
Okay, so one of the other interesting things, which is sort of we've touched on tonight, this hasn't been happening just in Xinjiang and not just in China, but communities, Uyghur communities around the world have had their families touched as well. Now, we have a sizable community here in Australia, Mantaman. Could you give it, we've actually seen the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade admit in recent weeks that a number of Uyghurs who are either citizens of Australia or permanent residents have been detained. And the Chinese government has refused to provide consular access or information. So could you, this must be extremely spooky for communities here, feeling that they're not even safe, even living in a country like Australia. Could you give a sense of the impact on the community and how you deal with this and how you stay in touch with people in Xinjiang when it's, even a phone call might be dangerous?
Let me pick up on the word that you have used, the sense of surprise. The first of all, this was quite a surprising event for the Uyghurs in Australia. But then there was a shock, and there was a depression. So there's a three stages of the emotional as well as a community response to this, the mass incarceration of the Uyghurs in Uyghur homeland. It was completely out of nowhere that Uyghurs were not prepared for this the sudden escalation and gradual escalation of the intensity of the Chinese government targeting the Uyghurs and in a very extrajudicial way. And hence the Australian Uyghurs are quite at a loss, emotionally speaking. So in Australia, we have more than 3,000 Uyghurs living in three cities, mainly in Adelaide, Melbourne, and Sydney. And so the Uyghur community in Australia is quite productive and law-abiding and also quite prosperous until recently. But this event and this tragedy, the humanitarian crisis, has made the Uyghurs quite sad, surprised, and depressed, as I said.
We have got some families here with family members who yes. sort of just disappeared.
Yes, and the almost all Uyghurs here in Australia have lost some family members, and their family members have disappeared into the concentration camps. And communication with the family members back home is almost impossible, but there's a small window for the Uyghurs to have kind of like some kind, get some glimpse into their whereabouts or whether they are alive or not. And that's the ultimate existential information they need, whether they're alive or not. Forget about their well-being.
So you're told where they are, whether they're alive or not, and that's it.
Even they don't know where they are, but just they can, to some extent, some of them can know where they are, like whether or not they are alive. And there's a special like app, like communication app called WeChat, through which Uyghurs are able to communicate with their parents and their relatives, friends, and siblings, etc. And this, with this app, you can't talk because all the communication is bugged by the China security agency. So it's the only way that you can talk is just see their face, if possible. Sometimes some of them may call them through this WeChat in a very limited time, but in most cases, it's the communication is almost like impossible. And hence, that goes to the heart of the fundamental human connection that the Australian Uyghurs are losing gradually. And they are so anxious about the well-being of the family members. And I am quite proud to say that the ABC and SBS are pioneering in reporting the dire situation of the Uyghur families in Australia. And there's lots of news. If I can compare some statistical data, so the Australia is quite spearheading in terms of reporting the plight of the Uyghur families who are unable to know whether or not the family members are alive. And also, Uyghurs have been mobilized to seek some assistance from the Australian government, in particular from the local MPs, federal and state MPs. And so this issue has been raised in Australian Parliament 2 months ago by the four Labour MPs, including Chris Hayes and Tony Zappia and others. But still, we are waiting for the Australian government to take a more strong action against the China's illegal incarceration of the Uyghurs. Yeah.
Thank you, Niri. Back to you. We know about this now. We know about the scale of it. China is coming under pressure to explain it or scale it back, whatever you want to say it. It does appear to be a form of ethnic assimilation, which we know over the long term won't work or would have a massive backlash of some kind. Yeah. What is your sense of, is the situation changing? Are the Chinese digging their heels in? Are they looking at results from it, or are we just having to set in now?
I don't think that the Chinese is realizing what they're up against. The international pressure is mounting. Legislative actions being taken, namely in the United States with the introduction of Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act, which would provide a legislative mandate for the administration to take some legal and policy action.
And that legal action might target people like the Magnitsky Act.
Exactly.
Target individual Chinese.
Individual Chinese and the enforcers of the current policies, in addition to the individuals who are taking leadership position. So presently, the liberal democracies have not spoken out in unison, except for the UPR in November in Geneva, and the diplomats in Beijing from 15-plus countries requesting to meet with Qin Chuanguo. I'd like to see more actions. I'd like to see...
You've just been in the parliament in Australia. You tell us about your conversations.
I've sensed from my conversation that there's a genuine interest, deliberation, thinking about what to do to stop this madness. We made a number of policy recommendations, one of which is to pass the Global Magnitsky Act, the Australian version of the Global Magnitsky Act. That will provide legal tools for the Australian government to go after those individuals. Sanction, freeze their assets, travel ban, I'm sure that some of China's officials will love to continue to send their children to Australia, and continue to invest in Australian businesses and buy properties. And one significant thing that has not been really talked about is this country's sovereignty is under attack. It is unacceptable for Chinese government either here or the United States to harass, threaten, and bully around our fellow citizens. It's totally unacceptable. I want to see a stronger position being taken, not by only the government, but also by people. So Uyghurs are our canaries in the coal mine. We desperately need help, moral, financial, governmental. So it's past time for action. I'd like to highlight lack of action. Silence is a tacit approval of some government or some individual's misbehavior. The Chinese should not win this run. If the world continue to stay or tiptoe around because of their trade relationship with China, because of their economic relationship, they will win. We will lose. And we will have a hard time to tell our children in the future, we know about this and we didn't know anything. That's a disgraceful thing that we should be concerned about.
The hard truth is that Australia is unlikely to get out ahead of America on individual sanctions and the like. You've been up on Capitol Hill talking to people like Marco Rubio, the senator, who's, I guess, one of the leading critics of China these days. Do you realistically expect the Magnitsky Act to be applied to Chinese officials?
The American officials have been discussing at the state, at the Pentagon, Congress, at the White House, since April. And it has been seen as kind of testing the water type of approach. But because of the leadership like Senator Marco Rubio with very specific policy objectives, a legislative mandate, I think there's some movement. We may see some real actions, governmental actions be taken by the end of the year. I like to believe that people are genuinely concerned because we were told never again. We're seeing this movie. We have seen this movie before. When a government uses a language like final solution, weeding out with chemicals, mental illness, describing your religion, trying to break your roots, connection, and trying to get into your life, sleeping on your bed, eating on your dining table, stopping on the middle of the street, checking your smartphone, and making you go through iris scan, that should have a chilling effect. This is a gut-checking movement for all of us.
The either Kelsey or David, another aspect of this which we haven't really touched on today in talking about the pervasive intrusion into Uyghur society is that many Chinese, Han Chinese, are also being sent to live in Uyghur homes, correct, and to report on them from inside their homes. This is on top of the, you know, the adult male being taken away. Have you tracked that at all?
I've read that it was something like 1.5 million officials have been deployed in homes, but I don't know much about what's happened there. David might know more.
I've only seen what's been written about it online. I believe these are party members from quite low level up to higher level, so sometimes quite young kids in cases. Who are being mobilized. In a sense, you know, this is sort of reminiscent of the kids being sent down to the countryside in the Cultural Revolution to some extent, although obviously they feel that they're performing a very important duty for the nation. It's just extremely hard to imagine. I mean, there's the unexpected guest. When I was studying Uyghur a long time ago, the unexpected guest is a sort of a metaphor in Uyghur for the Chinese to begin with. And now it's actually kind of being realized in practice at a personal level to have someone knock on your door. But I don't know where that policy fits into the plethora of...
I would just say, Richard, it's a small point, but I noticed that the Global Times released a propaganda video this week sort of rejecting these accounts of what's happening in Xinjiang. And said that they were temporary measures, and I've never seen that language used before. It said that the camps and the de-extremification program was a temporary measure, which I thought maybe might reflect the pressure or a shift.
Potential scaling back.
Yeah. potentially. I wouldn't be too optimistic, though.
On the house, the unexpected guest, there's almost like CCP Boy Scouts. They're sending them down to do good or something. It's quite, so you tell us about that as well.
Darren Baylor from University of Washington did an amazing piece after his visit and talking to real individuals being affected this policy. So this got into the point of Uyghur children when they see Chinese cadres come into the village. They chant, "I love Xi Jinping, I love CCP, CCP can save my, protect my life," that sort of thing. And then after they move in, I like to use metaphor to explain 1 million out, 1 million in. These individuals eat, sleep with them, and also checking their communications, who they're talking to, identify who should be sent to the camps. And the most jarring aspect of this intrusion of privacy is to make the children spy on their parents. This has been documented. So the Chinese government has been engaging this brutal policy in the multiple fronts and locking up those who have been suspicious or done something in the past, socially, intellectually, economically. And then go on to the lives of the ordinary citizen. And then another aspect is destroying our peaceful, prosperous livelihood in free societies. So they're attacking on a multiple front. So this is happening real time all over the place.
Mamertin, on that issue of multiple fronts and the issue that Nuri raised about sovereignty, I mean, do you have any evidence of Chinese surveillance in Australia of the Australian Uyghur community?
Yes. Australia is is not immune to the Chinese influence and as well as interference, which also includes the Uyghur communities here. And so it's more like coercive measures the Chinese government is using to silence Uyghurs here, not to raise their voice.
But give us an example.
For example, my wife received a call because the five brothers of my wife has been put in concentration camps. And I have no idea about my family members.
Five brothers.
It was reported in the Australian newspaper. Yeah. So the phone call was after that, the interview that she had with the Australian the newspaper. Then she received a call from unknown caller who said that she should shut up, otherwise the rest of the family members will pay their price. So this kind of intimidation policies, and we don't know where the call came from, either in from China or from Australia, even from China's embassy or consulate in Australia. So this is one of the quite prevalent and intrusive methods that the Chinese government is using to silence the Uyghurs overseas, including Australia. And the second one is we received very frightening calls from the Chinese embassy telling us that we have done something wrong, crime. We committed some crimes that we have to report ourselves back to the Chinese embassy. So we reported this case to the federal police, which took it on board, but it created great emotional havoc among our community members. And even to the degree that some of our community members felt frightened to see the Chinese people on the street. It went to that degree. And we also feel that some people like working for Chinese government, but which we don't know, we will never be able to verify this fact because China is using all leverages to silence Uyghurs in Australia. And number four is previously if the Uyghur person applies for a Chinese visa to go back to see their relatives, there was always conditions attached to the issuance of the home. But even if they successfully get the visa, but they will be interrogated upon the arrival. So then now the Chinese government is almost, Chinese embassy is almost not issuing any visa to the Uyghurs. But I have heard recently that two or three Uyghurs have gone back to China and see, but that is one of the leverage Chinese government to use to put pressure on the Uyghurs to work for them or spy on the Uyghurs here or the other things. So So these are the methods that we have known that Chinese government is using in Australia to again further suppress Uyghurs in a quite subtle or subtler way compared to the Uyghurs in our homeland.
Either David or Nuri, I mean, just to go back to this question of where on earth this whole system comes from. As you both know, you know, China since 1949 had a long tradition of re-education camps for political prisoners. And to be fair, you know, they have had debates in China, and a lot of legal scholars in China tried to get them wound back. That may have changed under Xi Jinping, but the system was reformed in some respects. Yeah. I mean, is this a sort of the same system on steroids with one community? Is it essentially similar?
This is rather different. I was born in the Chinese captivity at the height of Cultural Revolution.
And you went to university in China.
Similar camp. And I went to, after finishing high school education, Uyghur school, I went to live and breathe and study with the Han Chinese students in mainland China. So what is different this round is that the Chinese government, even disregarding its counterterrorism law, its constitution, criminal procedures. So the UN rightly described this as no right zone, no nothing, no lawyer, no procedure, no explanation. We have this young lady in the United States who spent 10 months in one of those camps, said that people are confused, and most of them don't know why they've been locked up. And just last night, I found out that one of the former Chinese citizens who managed to become a Kyrgyz parliamentarian disclosed that his brother was taken in. So this the population pool is expanding. It initially started with the Uyghurs and the Kazakhs, and now the Kyrgyz. So this whole thing is like a science fiction movie. People like to compare this to Orwellian society, but Chinese government is cooking up something. To me, they wanted to take full control of the Uyghur land and lives at the same time. And also this goes to the heart of Xi Jinping and CCP's survival. Some people may disagree, reasonable people may disagree with me, but this may have a domino effect. If there's a political turmoil, we're dealing with one man show in China, it's Xi Jinping's China. It's no longer a Politburo China. So CCP's survival, Xi Jinping's leadership, all tied to this incident or events. So, and as a Uyghur, I like to believe that there's a lot of racism in this. So one thing that I've been asking and observing that comes to mind is that no one said, no one recognized that the Chinese culture, kind of Chinese preference in life, the language is superior to anyone or universally accepted as such that Uyghurs and Tibetans must give up their life. So I think what is happening is a human engineering, biological engineering. It's a laboratory. The Chinese is using Uyghur lives and their homeland as a laboratory to test the water. If this works out, as you pointed out, we've been hearing disturbing news that this will be expanded to other parts of the Chinese territory. Not only that, authoritarian regimes, countries like Venezuela, Pakistan, right. This will be a new norm. Do we really want to live in the world that the Chinese new norm, Chinese disregard of international rule-based a system? Are we really prepared to live in such a society? So I challenge all of you. Think about it.
Thank you. Now, David, do you have anything to add on the issue of the education through labor, how this system compares to other...
There's no precedent, I think, for a policy that aims at this level of ideological and cultural uniformity across the population. I mean, it's not targeting, you know, specific crimes that people have committed or anything like that. It's a much more ambitious, and I think that is a break with the past in a sense. I mean, the previous party secretary in Xinjiang, one of the slogans that he raised was this idea of a people's war on terror, right? So the majority of people were still part of the war on terror on our side. You know, we were fighting the war on terror together, and that's completely flipped now. I mean, the people are part of the problem, not part of the solution now. And I think that we don't know enough yet about the internal party discussion that led to this. I think that's going to be a question that, you know, future historians are going to have to ponder. And but nonetheless, we can say that does mark quite a significant shift. And I think, you know, we can take that back into Imperial China, even when you look at the way that the state would respond to rebellions. You know, it was always this idea of, you know, a few bad apples spoiling the bunch. And that seems now to have gone out the window.
Since the entire community that's in the dock, essentially.
Well, the definition of what constitutes... We went from this idea of illegal religious activities, right? And then that sort of spread, you know, broadened into this idea of indications of potential radicalization, you know, in terms of dress and so on. Just kind of get wider and wider until you're sweeping up many things that were simply a normal part of Uyghur culture and religious life.
Yeah, no, it's the scale, ambition, techniques. Yeah. Okay, so let's have audience questions.
Hi there, my name's Aston. I'd like you to comment on the political aspects of the current crisis there in Xinjiang, particularly in terms of the countries that might respond or be sympathetic to the Uyghur struggle at the moment.
I'm going to say that's a good question because I forgot to ask anybody. We have not really had a single Muslim country condemn what's going on there. Anyway, so please, who wants to speak about that?
It seems completely counterproductive in terms of the Belt and Road policy. I mean, you would think that the neighbouring majority Muslim countries would be completely put offside by this just at a time when Beijing wants them on board. So,
plus Pakistan.
Yeah, and I mean, I fail to see the logic there.
I have a slightly different take on this particular question. If there was not BRI, well, Belt and Road Initiative, I think the Chinese Communist Party will come up with one or other reason to do whatever they do. Maybe not on this scale, but I see something that they're really, really worried about political turmoil in the future. It has a lot to do with their insecurity, and also has a lot to do with the way that they seeing Uyghurs' ethno-national identity as a source of political resentment. As for the Islamic countries, we all know most of them, vast majority of Muslim countries are not a Jeffersonian democracy. In order to have people to speak out and force their government to take an action, and you need to have a free press, you need to have freedom of speech, you need to have a freedom of assembly. So what we're dealing is mostly a weak authoritarian governments that have been taken hostage by Chinese influence, money. And now with the BRI, it's gotten even worse. I'm not inviting any Muslim groups to speak out for us, but I'd like to see moderate Muslim voices like Anwar Ibrahim of Malaysia and others, India, use their international influence.
I think Dr. Mahathir did make one
cursory
statement.
Yeah, he deserves a lot of credit for not sending Uyghur refugees back to China.
Right.
The Kazakh president, surprisingly, have done something right as well, not sending this Uyghur woman, Kazakh woman, was detained after arriving to Kazakhstan with a Chinese passport. So there's this small and very gradual process being taken. One organization I'd like to hear from is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, IOC. So Turkey has been a lost cause. I don't mess my word when it comes to Turkey. It used to be the only country with comfortable usage of the word genocide back in 2009. The current president was then the prime minister. So they also become interesting bedfellow with Xi Jinping. They blamed the United States, blamed Europe. For whatever the reason, they're looking east, walking away from the West, the democratic values. So again, we have to come up with the coalition of like-minded governments in the past, because we have a history. When that happened, as we've seen in the Cold War, we will win. So we need to work with what we have, not what we'd like to have.
Thank you, everyone. My name is Mehmet Çelepçi. I'm a migration agent. First of all, I would like to make a comment on what Mr. Nuri Türkel said. I am of Turkish background, and I don't think Turkey is a lost cause, because when in 2009 Turkey said the things happening in China was a genocide. There was no voice, significant voice coming up from Western world. Number one. Number two, on the 6th of November into 2018 in the UN meeting in Geneva, Turkey also one of the countries who did condemn what's happening in Eastern Turkestan and called on China to fix those problems, closed concentration camps and all that, even though they did not use the word Uyghur or Eastern Turkestan. Number three, Turkey has accepted at least 10,000 people from Malaysia and Thailand, while not even one of those people were accepted by the West. So I think it is unfair to put Turkey in a lost cause situation. Regarding Richard, if you don't mind, I would like to...
No, let's just get to the question, I think.
Yeah, okay. I was going to, because I'm a migration agent, I was going to mention something that would be helpful for your, like, evidence of Chinese surveillance in Australia. Would you like me to mention a few points?
Very quickly.
I am married to an Uyghur lady myself, and my stepson, at the age of 17, due to a request from his grandfather in China, had to go in front of his school, and also they have other relatives. They went to their own school with their identity cards in front of on their chest, photographs taken, and they had to send it to their relatives to prove what their relatives are doing in Australia. This is of course happening to a lot of people. This is Chinese surveillance and also abuse of the people, Australian citizens and citizens of other countries.
Now your question.
Yeah, my question is, please, obviously China is carrying out a policy to abandon the Uyghur language, abandon religious beliefs, and the culture of the Uyghur people, which is an extermination policy. Uyghurs call it catastrophe. This is kind of Holocaust of Uyghur people. The West has to do something about this. Otherwise, failure cannot be and must not be.
Question.
So my question is, please, what are the chances of West succeeding? Sorry, this is
pushing
a very difficult
back.
Question.
Well, I guess Nuri talked about this, but why don't you expand what you talked about? We always talk about the US. What about Europe, for example, if you're looking at democracies?
European Union, we're very pleased to hear that Netherlands is in the process of introducing the EU version of the Global Magnitsky Act, which has been already nodded by Germany, which is a very good sign. European Union and some European allies of the United States, based on what we've been able to find out, has been in a deliberate conversation about this issue. I can't get into the specifics of what's being discussed, but I do see that there's a genuine interest based on our interactions with various government officials. We have colleagues in Europe actively lobby the European Union and the UN in Geneva. Couple of things that they can do. Continue to press this ambassadorial visit in tandem with other countries outside of EU.
That's the visit to party secretary.
Yeah, they will deny, but you should continue to press. And also, European Union, Australia, and the United States should attach the current humanitarian crisis to the trade dialogue. Because that's the language that the Xi Jinping's China understands.
Right.
And then the third, European Union also should consider a policy act, because we live in a historic period, a particular time in the history. And then the fourth specific thing that the EU should do is to accept Uyghur refugees being bounced around in Middle East. We have a serious refugee crisis. And then finally, because the Uyghur students have been unable to receive money from their family because they either been detained or receiving money between China and the foreign countries can be seen as a sign of a problem that may result in the... So universities should take a leadership role providing scholarship and tuition waiver. And also the communities all around the world, again, should reach out to the governments and representatives to encourage them to take some bold action. And finally, some of you may not like it. If the Chinese does not take a real action, maybe recalling ambassadors might be something that they should consider.
Okay, so what time for one very last quick question over here.
My name is Bakhtiar Bora. According to my brother back in my hometown, he's about 80 years old. My nephew, my niece, my nephew and his wife and two nieces and their husbands look up in 10 months concentration camp after sentenced to 16 to 18 years. Just before I went to Geneva, that's the November the 6th demonstration, and my sister, who get this information from my brother, my brother said back in my hometown, please tell Bakhtiar shut up, because I'm the activist in the last 30 years. Now, my question is, I'm a 30 years Australian citizen and taxpayer. Because of me, my activity in my people's sake, and my outspeaking about my people in my country and for freedom, and that's why they look up my six relatives and sentenced to 18 years. Australian government or Australian constitution protect me or not?
Should they protect you in Australia? Is that the question?
Yeah, because of me.
Yeah.
My own
your relatives have been. Yes, have been. Yeah.
Because I'm outspeaking.
Yes.
I'm the activist.
Yes.
For freedom of my people.
That's right.
That's the reason.
Right, but the question is, what should can the Australian government do? Right, for your relatives.
Exactly.
Right. Well, I think you kind of addressed that, Nuri, didn't you? I mean, it's greater consular pressure, I mean, which is an entirely legitimate diplomatic dialogue.
Yeah, I think I'm learning Australian politics. I can't get into too much of specifics.
We're all learning these days.
Yeah, aren't we living an interesting time?
Yeah.
I think the embassy should get involved a little bit more proactively. At least what embassy could do is to find out the whereabouts of Australian citizens' remaining family members. The constant pressure based on the former prisoners in China yields a good result. Put the government on notice.
Anybody else want to make a comment?
I have to add my previous speech. Three Australian citizens and six Australian permanent members were harassed, and six Australian permanent members actually have been put in the concentration camps.
Three citizens and six
Australian permanent residents. So Australia made it clear to us that Australia is under no obligation to protect the Australian permanent residents, but Australia is under the perfect obligation to protect its citizens in China. So there was a controversial issue that one of the Australian citizens were put in custody where he had not been able to get the consular access for some time. So we took this matter up to the higher level, and ultimately the DFAT, the Department of Foreign Affairs and the Trade, intervened a bit late, but finally he rescued from China. So in that sense, the Australian... Yes, finally, yeah, successfully, but it took some time for Australia to act actually genuinely and seriously. So the question is that we haven't been able to get this information from the DFAT or the other departments of Australia, whether or not Uyghur citizens can get any kind of assistance for their family members who have been put in a concentration camp. So it's still unclear. It's like uncharted territory for us to. So in that sense, Australian position on this matter is still unclear, even ambiguous.
Yeah.
Because you
want it to be hardened.
We want to be hard and also clear. And also, this is like as Mr. Bakhtiar said, is that is just because of the we are Australian citizens, just because of our political activism in this country, that our family members are paying a very heavy price there. So from the humanitarian point of view, the Australian government at least should be able to put pressure on China to stop that any kind of political harassment of their family members. This is quite legitimate and quite commonsensical request from the Uyghurs in Australia. But nothing has been done so far, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, look, we've got to end it there. Thank you all for coming, and thanks in particular to my panelists for giving us such a full exposition of an incredibly difficult problem. Thank you very much.